Hey everybody, how's it going? How's everybody doing tonight? Rob's got the evening off, so he's asked me to fill in for him, and I'm going to do the best I can. And we're going to continue on through the Proverbs. And tonight we're going to be taking a look at Proverb 27. And as you know, we've gotten pretty far in this. We're actually coming to the end of the book of Proverbs now. We're getting pretty close. And I think it's been a really exciting and valuable journey that we've taken through it. And I know, me personally, I often go back to the Proverbs. And, you know, since God's Word is alive, and because our circumstances change, I feel as though it's good to revisit them and to reread them and to see, you know, not new truths, but new things that apply to our lives and new things that we could gather from them. And and the Proverbs are full of, you know, obviously full of timely wisdom that's always right on. You know, one thing, going through the Proverbs and everything like that, we can think that they're steps to being good at Christianity or to becoming a good Christian or something like that. We want to make sure that we never get into that kind of frame of mind, because there's no code of ethics or set of morals that's ever going to turn us into a good Christian. It's Christ alone that makes us good, and we have to remember that. But we also remember the fact that the fall has created a darkness on this earth and a darkness in our minds, and made us kind of forget who we are and who we belong to, and as a result, it's made us forget the values that represent the kingdom that we actually belong to. And so when we look to God's Word and we look to these Proverbs, we start to regain our memory and we start to realize the values that we're called to and the values of the kingdom that we represent. So as we go through here, you know, when we see ourselves in this Word, it's almost like a self-examination, and that's what I really like about it. It gives me a perspective on you know, is this really happening in my life? Is this what I'm becoming? Are these values the kind of values that I express in my daily life as I go about? So, like I said, we're going to be taking a look at Proverbs 27 tonight. And you know, I think as we reacquaint ourselves with God's Word and we and the darkness is lifted off of our lives and God comes into our lives and starts to remind us of who we are and where we're going, I think that this reacquaintance with these values deepens our relationship with Him. And I think that it's an important part of building that relationship, that ongoing relationship that we have with Him as we go through this. So we'll start here in verse 1. And it says, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring." And immediately when I read this, I think of a couple of verses from James. And in James 4:13, it says, "Now listen, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go to this city or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that." You know, it's a good thing to make plans. I don't think there's anything wrong with making plans. But to proclaim that this is how it's going to be, this is what's going to happen, this is, you know, how things are going to take place, and this is, you know, how life is going to be for me is you know, like he says here, boasting. And you know, this isn't a proverb that's necessarily in the Bible, but there's a modern proverb that says, if you want to make God laugh, go ahead and tell him your plans. And I'm sure that we've all heard that, because things do change. And you know, we should save for tomorrow, we should plan, we should have a vision for our lives and for our families' lives, but those visions and those plans should be very flexible. And those visions and those plans should always find themselves in God's will for our lives. Because even if money comes and goes, jobs come and go, houses, 401ks, stocks, bonds come and go, businesses come and go, everything comes and goes, if we place our hope and our plan and our vision in God's will, then we're secure. You know, we're secure in our future no matter what happens. And that, you know, that's what it's all about. So, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Verse 2, let another praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. And obviously this is dealing with pride and the idea of bringing affirmation or attention to ourselves. Another way to put this might be to say, don't go around trying to get the credit that you think you deserve for the things that you do. But the funny thing is that we do stuff like this in order to draw attention to ourselves, because we want people to think better of us, or we want people to like us more, or to say that we're okay with them or whatever like that. And the weird thing is when we do this kind of stuff, it has the opposite effect. It really does. Nobody really likes someone who goes around and brags about themselves and says how, it's not that they don't like them, they don't like to be around someone who goes around and brags about themselves and says what a great person they are and all the great things they've done. Actually, you get filled up of that pretty quick, and you'd like to get away from someone like that. We get worn out from hearing them convince us of just how great they are. So, it does. It has a weird opposite effect. There's nothing wrong with being proud of our accomplishments or our children. There's nothing wrong with being proud of our families or our homes or anything like that. But if we choose a path of trying to get affirmation and acceptance from other people based upon our accomplishments or the things that we do, we're going to have a hard time keeping it. And we're never going to have to stop working for it. We become slaves to public opinion, and it's fickle because public opinion is constantly changing. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get the approval of other fallen human beings, and that changes like the wind. So the problem is that we'll often base our worth or importance or acceptance on what other broken, fallen human beings think about us and not what God has already said about us. This thing, I'm sorry, it keeps falling off my ear or something. Hang on. Sorry about that. God's love and acceptance for us are evident, and we don't need the approval of other people. I know I've, we've heard this before and I've said this before, but it's true. We don't need the approval of other fallen human beings. I mean, I love people, but I know who I am in God. I mean, it's okay, you know, it's okay. It's okay who I am in God, and I'm accepted and loved by Him. So if we open our mouths to praise anyone, it should be Him. It's God, after all, that's provided us with the gifts and the abilities to make anything good come of our lives anyway. So, if there's to be any glory given at all, it should go to Him. So He deserves the glory for anything good that comes from us. Okay, verse 3. A stone is heavy and sand is weighty, but a fool's provocation is heavier than both. Okay, have you ever seen the A-Team TV series where Mr. T says, "I pity the fool"? Has anybody ever heard that before? what this is saying is... I pity the person who... You know, what he was trying to say was that... I pity the fool who gets involved with me because I'll straighten him out. But what this is saying is I pity the person who gets involved with the fool because the fool is going to mess him up. But anyway, I said that all wrong. But this verse, on the other hand, says to pity the unfortunate person the fool messes with. The idea here is that the fool is going to do foolish things that make no sense to anyone but himself. Most of the time, if we're provoked by a fool, there is no reason. There's no good reason at all. And there's probably no good resolution or anyone that the fool would ever accept. So even if there is a good resolution, a fool will probably scoff at it, and that's mainly because a fool thinks foolishly. The whole conflict is usually silly, not only without reason, but without end. It's one of those things that becomes very weighty for us because we spend a lot of energy and time trying to figure out a solution when there is no solution. We become frustrated with the situation, and we can't get away from it. What I think Solomon's saying here is it's actually easier for us to carry a big bag of wet cement and stones home from the beach than it is to deal with a situation like this. So, I mean, what do we do? It's a hard thing to do, but I would say not to let people who act foolishly and call us into provocation get under our skin. And that's a difficult thing to do sometimes, and we all know. But, it's heavy. So, okay, verse 4. What is cruel? Wrath is cruel. Anger is overwhelming. But who can stand before jealousy? Okay, jealousy is a very dangerous emotion. There's no doubt about it. It carries with it more power than wrath or anger. And once wrath or anger have been satisfied, they kind of lose their power. And even if they never do get satisfied, even if someone's anger is never satisfied, it kind of dissipates over time. And it's the same thing with wrath. But jealousy is in a way, it's like bitterness. It's the kind of a thing that could continue to burn and grow inside of you and develop into something that could take years. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible emotion. Jealousy is more, when we think about jealousy, we also think about envy or covetousness, but it's more than that. It's, jealousy, envy or covetousness is more or less desiring what another person has, desiring what another person possesses, even to the point where we're willing to do something underhanded or misguided in order to get it. Jealousy, on the other hand, is really a fear or insecurity of losing something important to us that can cause us to think badly about that situation. And those feelings can take us over. I don't know if anybody in here has ever felt jealousy before. I know I have, and it's one of those things. It's like bitterness. It's like anger. It just grabs you and kind of twists the inside of you a little bit. And it's a good thing to get out of you as soon as possible. But it can get so deeply rooted into someone's lives that it becomes their very state of being. It's a lot like bitterness that way. It actually becomes their identity. Inside of them, they're burning with jealousy. We see the outwardly destructive power of jealousy. There's plenty of examples in the Bible. Cain killed Abel because he was jealous of him. Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery and off he went to Egypt because they were jealous of the relationship that he had with his father. Saul was so overwhelmed with jealousy for David that it raged inside of him. It became the main focus of his life. He even got to the point where he couldn't control it, and it totally controlled him. I mean, we read that. So Saul even tried to kill David on several occasions because of it. And I don't know if I agree with this, but some Bible interpretations even say that Satan's demise was and his eventual fall and everything was because he was jealous of God and God's power and authority. So jealousy is dangerous to the one, to the one who's a target of it. It's the outward danger of it is evident there. You know, there's murder and all kinds of things involved. But with Saul, he even started hurling spears at David. So even if an outwardly physical manifestation of the jealousy someone feels never comes to pass, it still has a way of manifesting inside the person who's feeling it and eating away at the person. It robs that person of so much energy that it becomes nearly impossible for them to do any good. All they can do is focus on their own jealousy. And we become consumed and it becomes a monster inside of us that no one can stand before, like it says, but who can stand before jealousy? It can destroy us from the inside out. Now, I know somebody here is thinking, but it says in the Bible that God was jealous, right? In Exodus 24, it does. God says, you shall not make for yourselves an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. The difference here, it is jealousy, but what this is with God is it's a justified jealousy. The people of Israel belonged to God. They were his people, and the relationship that they had with God didn't allow for them to worship other gods. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. They were, in essence, committing adultery against God. And so God's jealousy is justified in that. And I think Paul's jealousy is justified in the same reason when he says in 2 Corinthians 11:2, I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. So his jealousy is not justified because those people belong to him or anything like that, but because Paul had preached the pure gospel to them, and now false teachers had come in and were teaching another gospel to them, and it was not the pure gospel. And what it was happening was it was turning them away from Christ. So I know that it looks one jealousy is bad, one jealousy is good, but jealousy when it's justified, I think from a biblical perspective, seems okay. So how do you justify jealousy? Well, I think that's kind of a hard thing, and honestly, I would do everything I could to stay away from it. But I think that some jealousy could also be justified in a marriage relationship. I mean, it's a tricky thing, and I think if a spouse is actively engaged in like flirting or actually cheating on someone, marriage jealousy could be justified, but I'd be cautious because jealousy in a marriage is often more trouble than good, and a lot of times it's not justified because it's built on fear or suspicion or control or something like that. So anyway, avoid this stuff at all costs. It's a horrible thing. Enough on jealousy. Verses 5 and 6, can you believe it? We're only on verse 5 and 6? Holy cow, we're going to be here all night. No, I'm just kidding. I'm going to fly through this. You're going to see. No, really, I am. Rebuke is basically telling, 5 and 6, better is open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the words of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Rebuke is basically telling someone to shape up and live a better life. It can be very uncomfortable for the person who's doing the rebuking as well as the person who's being rebuked. There's no doubt about it. And this even says open rebuke, which gives me the impression that it could be in a public place. That really could be embarrassing for most people, both ends of it. Although it could bring shame to someone, it's better than letting someone you truly care about continue on in a lifestyle that you know that's destroying them. I mean, rebuke is a correction. It's a calling to live a better life. So imagine it this way. If we were to go to a doctor with a rash, and the doctor said, "Oh, well, there's nothing really to worry about there." There we go. Okay, I was sitting on it. That's why I was doing that. There's nothing really to worry about there, but in actuality, it was like some kind of skin cancer or something like that. But because he didn't want to deal with us getting upset or scaring us or anything like that, he figured it would best just take an aspirin and go home and get some rest. You'll be fine. He'd be doing us a great misjustice, wouldn't he? I mean, there's no doubt about it. But I guess the main reason why it's uncomfortable for us to actually rebuke someone is because we may feel like we're hurting someone's feelings, and that would definitely keep me from doing that. I mean, I don't want to hurt anybody, and that can make it difficult. But it's better that someone's feelings are hurt, which at best are temporary, than the long-term effects of just letting a friend or someone that you love continue on. Now, don't everybody come up to me and say, "Luke, you need to lose weight," because I already know, and I have some close friends who have talked to me and even said that they'll sweat it out right next to me. So I've been rebuked already. I know. I'm working on it. I'm sorry. But okay, now the other thing is I want to qualify this by saying that this is not a license to run around pointing out everybody's defects and shortcomings. This is something that we never want to do. That is not loving rebuke. That's like weirdo. That's weirdness. It's callous. Actually, I have written down here that it's callous accusation and condemnation. And those are horrible things that we would never want to give to anybody. This is not a license for us to go around and start telling everybody how to live their lives. So we never want to get that impression from it. I feel like in order for us to speak into anyone else's lives, anyone at all, there has to be some kind of a track record of friendship first. We have to gain a person's respect through a relationship with that person before we can go around telling them that they need to live a better life. You know, there's no doubt about it. We don't want to go around and correct and encourage people to live a better life that we don't have a relationship with. It will never stick. It'll never go through. If we've gained that trust and respect, the person being corrected is more likely to receive that correction and to understand where we're coming from because they know that it's coming in love. And that's the important thing. It's not like, you know, at first it's going to be uncomfortable, but, you know, if we think about it and we know the person who that rebuke is coming from and we know that there's love involved with that, it's much easier to accept. And with rebuke, there should always come, you know, if we do tell somebody they should be living a better life, we ought to offer to help them in that and to encourage them in that and to bring them along in that. So anyway, so the other thing that it talks about here is something called hidden love. And what I could find out about hidden love is, I guess, the opposite of what we're talking about here. It can be defined as a shallow relationship that looks like friendship on the outside, but it lacks any commitment or courage to be real with each other. It could actually be described as a selfish friendship. We're both getting all the benefits of being a friend, the emotional affection, the companionship and everything like that, but we're not making any kind of real commitment to each other. And the relationship lacks any type of real substance or trust. And, you know, we hear about, you know, in the Bible and in real life, we hear about people who will surround themselves with hidden love, these so-called friends that would never, ever speak against them, these people who would always tell you what you want to hear. These people who would, you know, would always tell you what you want to hear and would never tell you how things really are. And we can see that it becomes a downfall for a lot of people. These so-called friends offer lip service instead of friendship by telling them everything they want to hear instead of the truth, and the truth that could save somebody's life. Okay, verse 7. One who is full loathes honey, but to one who is hungry, everything bitter is sweet. I think this is kind of like what Rob was talking about last week. Remember when he was talking about the sluggard who had trouble bringing the spoon to his mouth? He was so full that it was a burden for him to actually bring the food up to his mouth. And obviously this extends beyond food and describes such an abundance and of luxury that even the finest things become not very special to a person. While in contrast, a hard-working person who doesn't have much at all and has to work for everything they have, even the littlest bit of luxury becomes, you know, a precious gift. So we have to be careful as Americans because we have so much that we don't have a tendency to take everything for granted that we have. What can happen with so much luxury is instead of being thankful and content for whatever we may have, we become resentful or depressed over what we don't have. And I know that I've done that myself many times, actually. And, you know, this really struck home with me a couple of years ago. Most of you know Sabet. They have, Sabet and Susie were here, and they were here at our church for about a year. And we had planned on making a new promotional video for their ministry. And he had a bunch of Video 8 tapes that he was going to bring up here, just boxes and boxes of them. And we were going to go through them and edit out different pieces and things like that and kind of put together a video for him. So he was supposed to meet me, I don't know, one day around 11 o'clock or something. And that morning, after I got Patrick off to school, I was home doing dishes and doing laundry and just getting my house in shape and everything like that. And I remember complaining to myself about the drudgery of the repetitiveness of housework and I got to do the dishes again and blah, blah, blah. And I remember feeling kind of like just, you know, cranky and just upset about it in general. You know, I remember complaining about it. I don't know if I was complaining to myself or God or what, but I was not happy. It was drudgery. So anyway, I came up here and I met with Sabet and we were over in the movie room over there and he started showing me these videos and everything like that. And lo and behold, I think it was God who had planned this whole thing, but there was this village that he had visited on the video tape there of somebody's hut, a doorless hut with a dirt floor, and he said, "Now this is the woman's kitchen here." And it was like a plastic oil drain pan full of really dirty water laying on this dirt floor. And then there was another kind of salvaged oil can, and he said, "Now that would be the water that they would use to cook the dinner with." And then all these like little plastic things that look basically like garbage, and that was what they ate off of and everything like that. Would be things that we would throw away, you know. And I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, I was struck to the core. I knew right away. I was like, this is God talking to me and telling me how stupid I am. Right now, right here, right now. And I'll tell you what, I was so convicted and just so moved by that that I didn't say anything to Sabette yet. It was about to come, but, I just felt like I could just, I needed to repent and get on my knees right then. I mean, it was horrible. I was so struck by it. But, there was plenty more for me to see. God had planned for me to see plenty more because, he went on to show me this kind of swampy area with all these reeds and stuff where the people go down to do their laundry. And he went on to tell me about the wounds that these people had on their arms where there was parasites in the water that would infect their, that would go through their skin when they were doing their laundry and cause infections and things like that in their arms while they were doing their laundry. And that was not all. The next video, okay, and this whole time I'm thinking, I was complaining about the dishes and the laundry. I was complaining. The next video was this little video. He goes, and this is kind of cool. This is a video of a black mamba. They hide in the reeds down by the swamp down there where they do the laundry and stuff. Has anybody ever heard of a black mamba? It's like the most poisonous snake in Africa. And so, you know, and here I am, this guy from Panama City Beach complaining about my dishes and my laundry. And thank God I have food to put on those dishes and clean water and a sink to wash them in. And God has provided all those things for me and I'm complaining about them. And a laundry room with clean water and a washer and a dryer. And a place where all I have to do is go out and put, and it even rings when it's done. I can go out there and get it when I don't even have to stand there with it. I mean, holy cow. I'll tell you what, anytime that I start to feel full of honey, I remember that video and it takes me back. I mean, I still am a stupid American, but I was a really stupid American then. I mean, I feel like that morning changed my life. And then I talked to Sabette about it and we prayed and stuff like that, but kind of puts a whole new spin on doing laundry. Like the man who loathed honey, I took for granted all that God had provided for me, the plates, the silverware, the food, everything. I took everything for granted. So terrible. Okay, verse 8. Like a bird that strays from its nest is a man who strays from his home. And honestly, I think this is probably, it was kind of funny at first, but what I think this is probably talking about is this is talking about a parent or a spouse, not necessarily a man, but for whatever reason, they're leaving their home and their family and going off to pursue some selfish, you know, selfish pleasure away from the home. And, you know, I mean, that's what it looks like, a man who strays from his home. It kind of gives me that it kind of says that to me, but you know, a bird who strays from their home or strays from the nest leaves behind you know, little hungry chicks. You see them on the videos. They're just little tiny things, unable to defend themselves, and they're always crying. It seems like they're always starving, and then the mom comes and gives them food and everything like that. Well, if those little chicks are not tended for and they're not taken care of, they're going to starve to death. You know, it's a cruel and it's an unnatural thing for a bird to do that, for a bird to leave its nest. It's something that, you know, you just don't hear about, in other words. But I think that it's what it does in this proverb here is it relates to us the severity of the situation of a parent walking away from the home, walking away from the spouse and the family and the kids and everything like that. I mean, it's a horrible situation and it's a completely unnatural situation. I read something here that, you know, it affects every part of the family's lives and disrupts a child's upbringing. Children starve not only financially, but emotionally as well. The sad and horrible thing is, as I read somewhere, that like 20 to 30% of parents take absolutely no contact with their families at all, make no contact with their kids at all. That's incredible. That's a gigantic number. They leave and they never look back. They don't make any kind of contribution into their children's lives. Now, I would say that if we are parents or we're spouses, that there is no higher calling in this world than to be there and to be supporting that family, and that there's nothing. There's no greater good. There's no, God would never call us away from that. A spouse and a parent, as spouse and parents, there's no more important thing for us to be doing than to be present and caring for our family physically, emotionally, and financially. I think anything short of this is unnatural as a bird abandoning their nest. And I can tell you, I actually grew up in a home where my dad left when I was 5 years old. And it caused havoc. It was destructive to everybody involved, and eventually it was destructive to him. So that's what happens. It's a horrible thing, and it's an unnatural thing. So verses 9 and 10. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. Do not forsake your friend and your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother who is far off. Okay, it's been proven that pleasant aromas have a positive healing effect on us. Has anybody ever heard of like aromatherapy and stuff like that? It's kind of cool. It uses certain aromas and fragrances and things like that to kind of turn your day around. If you're feeling kind of blue or sad or whatever, you can, you know, kind of smell these things, and all of a sudden you're having a, kind of a pleasant day. They say that even a quick sniff of these certain scents can turn your day around and just change your whole attitude towards things. And I'm still trying to find the ones that smell like chocolate chip cookies and pot roast, but I don't know. We'll see if anybody finds them. I would have to agree that that in the same way, earnest counsel of a friend has the same effect. You know what I'm saying? About a year ago, I know some of you know that I was going through a very difficult time because I was faced with a sudden upheaval in my life, and painful things were happening that were out of my control. I couldn't stop them from happening, and I couldn't fix what was happening. But I was very hurt and confused, and the whole thing seemed very unfair. And I'm not going to go into details, but I was completely overcome at that time with my own grief and emotions. And I spent a lot of time slipping in and out of self-pity and depression and all the good things that go along with, you know, having your life turned upside down. But I had been deeply hurt. And without my relationship with Christ, I feel like I would never have made it through that. He was constantly there, tending to my wounds, healing me, you know, telling me that I was loved, bringing me through it. And I feel like he just never left my side through the whole thing. And I strongly believe that. But the most amazing thing of all, and what I felt most of all, was the people that Jesus sent to me, and for one was the counsel that they brought with them, and that was the greatest thing of all, because what happened was when things went bad, I realized how many friends I had, and their compassion and their love for me was obvious, and it helped to pull me through it. And I believe that Jesus used the people that were around me in order to do that and to heal me. And it talks about earnest counsel. And out of all the things, I mean, I was surrounded by friends. I have got to thank everybody who was there by my side and helped me get through it. But there was earnest counsel, and earnest counsel. And this is the only way that I can say it. Earnest counsel was the people who gave me the counsel were compassionate and caring and thoughtful, but they wouldn't let me continue to stay in my self-pity. You understand what I'm saying? They would, like, if I was feeling self-pity, they would say things that would counter the self-pity, in other words. Well, that I understand that, and I understand what you're going through, but you have to, you know, and things like that. And it wasn't just going along and saying, yeah, this stinks, and just telling me what I wanted to hear and keeping me going, but it was the kind of counsel that wasn't just telling me what I wanted to hear, but that was trying to help me to heal and to come through this and to see that there was something better on the other side of this. And that's what I believe earnest counsel is. It's something special. It's genuine. It's sympathetic, and it's loving, and it's caring, but it's not going to let you stay where you're at. It's not going to enable you to continue on in your own depression and self-pity. Does that make sense? Yeah, it's cool. And I believe that it's compassion mixed with Christ-like wisdom. And God uses us to bring that to one another. And that is amazing. I felt Jesus so strong through that. So thank you. Verse 11, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad that I may answer him who reproaches me. Okay, I've got to say that I've found so much joy in my relationship with my son that it's hard to compare it to anything else here on earth. You know, I mean, it's just a wonderful thing to have him. He's an outstanding person. And I know that everybody says that about their kid, but honestly, Patrick's different. He really is. He is. Come on. I'm not bragging or boasting or anything like that, but I have. I've noticed things about, and I don't know if I've ever talked about this up here before, but I've noticed things about him that I have not noticed about myself or anybody else in my family. And there's certain things, there's certain kind of personality things in him that are different, and they're wonderful. I mean, I don't understand. I don't know where he gets it from. But like, okay, I'm just going to give you one example, and then I'll stop bragging about him. When he was like, we were at his like seventh birthday. We had his birthday down at Rocket Lanes, and we had a birthday party for him. And him and his friends were bowling, and they had pizza and everything like that. And about four lanes down, there was a group of kids, and you know, they were probably, you know, maybe when I say kids, they were teenagers. They were, you know, 18, 21, something like that. But they were all really loud and boisterous, and they were drinking. And I think Luke was there, maybe. But Luke used to go to Patrick's birthday parties up there. But anyway, no, he wasn't drinking. But these teenagers or whatever were down there. They're drinking. They're having a good time, and they're bowling, and they're loud, and they're boisterous, and everything like that. And then all of a sudden, this girl throws the ball, and when she throws the ball, she slipped on something. One of them had spilled something or something like that. She slipped on something, went up in the air, and boom, flat down, and her glasses went flying, the ball made a big noise, and everybody just started laughing. It was all of her friends, and I think she might have even been laughing, but I just stood there like stunned, like I didn't know what to do. Some of the kids that were over here were laughing, and all the adults that were over here were just like stunned looking, and Patrick didn't even think, not an instant. He put down his ball and went right over there, picked up the girl's glasses, and started helping her up, asking her if she was okay. 7 years old. 7 years old. All of her friends are laughing. We're all standing around stunned and stupid. And there's something different there, isn't there? I mean, I'm not just bragging on him. There's something different there. And I'm so proud of him. And it makes my heart glad. And that's what I'm trying to get to. I know that may not sound like a big thing, but it's something that I will have in my heart forever. It's something that I'll hang on to that brings me a lot of joy. It would be, but on the other hand, because our kids are a kind of reflection of who we are, as this says, you know, up here, that the values that they have can bring a lot of dishonor to a family if they act evil or foolish. So it would be especially hard for a person of prominence, like a public figure or a president or something, if their kids were always in the news causing trouble. So I know that's nothing that Patrick's ever going to do, but I'm not boasting about tomorrow either. Don't. But so this proverb can apply to. So you know, we can look at this and you know, as the proverbs become, like I talked about in earlier, a self-examination. We can look at this and apply it to us as children of God. Right? Are we bringing joy to the hearts of our Father, and to the heart of our Father? Are our actions making God glad and things, or are they bringing reproach and people questioning and criticizing God because of us? I think you know, if we end up in a place where we're the kind of people who are standing on a corner, condemning other people because of, or saying that they're going to go to hell, or condemning them because of their lifestyle choices or something like that, I think that may bring reproach on our Father. Whereas if we're the kind of people who spread love, which goes a lot further than condemnation and that kind of, that other kind of stuff, that condemnation stuff, that God hates them because of their lifestyle or whatever, if we share love, it'll bring joy to our Father on the other hand. So that's something we got to remember. Okay, verse 12, the prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. Okay, I'm sure that you've seen the YouTube videos, the guy's in his kitchen, the wind's blowing like crazy, he's got a little camera and he's videotaping out in the backyard, and there's a twister out there that's like the size of Texas. And it's like coming across the backyard and it's like, you know, a couple of feet away. He's not the prudent one. Okay, all the prudent people for 50 miles around are already in their basements. But thank God for the simple people, because we wouldn't have all those cool videos. Okay, verse 13. Take a man's garment when he is put up security. Take a man's garment when he has put up a security for a stranger, and hold it in pledge when he puts up security for an adulteress. I don't know. These are obviously instructions on how to operate a pawn shop or a brothel or something. I don't really know. But if you ever find yourself loaning money to someone you don't know, or a prostitute, then you want to get something for it, so you can kind of make sure that you get the money back. You know, you want to hold something of theirs so that you get the money back. But I don't know. I don't know if that's ever going to apply to any of us here. Verse 14, whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. This is another interesting one. I have a feeling that these, you know, you have these two guys here. I have a feeling that one guy means well by what he's doing. He may have gotten up a little early. He's kind of excited, happy, jealous. It's a beautiful day, and I just want to share it with my friend. He's, you know, he's over there sleeping, and he calls him up and he says, "Hey, buddy, wakey, wakey, come on, jump up. We're gonna go." You know, and the other guy's been up all night with some kind of food poisoning or something like that, and he's on the, just hanging up. So I think the message here is to try and see things from other people's perspective. Is that even though we mean well, sometimes when we're trying to do good for somebody, we could actually be causing them a hassle. So it's just that everybody is going through something different. Everybody is dealing with something different, and we just want to see it that way. Zealousness is good, but I don't know. We want to take the other person's viewpoint and things into perspective before we go crazy. Okay, verse 15 and 16. A continual dripping on a rainy day. Oh, this is a good one. Continual dripping on a rainy day and a quarrelsome wife are alike. To restrain her is just to restrain the wind, or to grasp oil in one's right hand. Okay. Rob's gone over this before, you know, because this has turned up in Proverbs before, so I'm not going to bother with it. But, what? But I do have a little story. If you think we have time, you think we have time to hear it? You want to hear a quick story? Okay, an old hillbilly farmer had a wife who nagged him mercifully. From morning till night, and sometimes later, she was always complaining about something. The only time he got any relief was when he was out plowing with his old mule. One day when he was out plowing, his wife brought him lunch in the field. He drove the old mule into the shade, sat down on a stump, and began to eat his lunch. Well, immediately she began nagging him. "Can't you eat your lunch while you're working? You know, blah, blah, blah," and on and on and on. Well, all of a sudden, the old mule lashed out with both feet behind and caught her in the head and killed her. Horrible, right? This is just a story. Don't worry. At the funeral several days later, the minister noticed something rather odd. When a woman mourner would approach the old farmer, he would listen for a minute, then nod his head in agreement. But when a man mourner approached him, he would listen for a minute, then shake his head in disagreement. This was so consistent that the minister decided to ask the old farmer about it. So after the funeral, the minister spoke to the old farmer and asked him why he nodded his head and agreed with the women, but always shook his head and disagreed with all the men. So the old farmer said, "Well, the woman would come up and say something about how my wife looked so nice and how pretty her dress was, so I would nod my head in agreement." And the minister said, "Well, what about the men?" They wanted to know if the mule was for sale. I'm sorry. That was really bad. I'm sorry. But I couldn't resist. I thought it was kind of cute. And honestly, does not relate to just women, okay? This includes everybody. And we don't want to go around nagging each other. Man, woman, child, father, brother, sister, friends. We don't want to nag each other. It's a horrible thing. And the way that Solomon kind of talks about it here is it can be so bad that we can leave somebody feeling trapped without escape. Because you think about a rainy day in a house that's dripping. There's no way to get away from the rain. You go outside, you're going to get wet. Back in those days, they didn't have a car to drive down to the mall or anything like that. You stay in the house, it's a constant nag. So, don't nag each other. It's good thing. Spouse or friend or whatever. So, man, woman. Verse 17, iron sharpens iron and one man sharpens another. I believe this is just talking about how we all come from a very diverse set of backgrounds, and we have a lot of differences, and we should, as a community, when we get together or we have friends, we should celebrate those differences. What's cool is because of the differences that we have an opportunity to learn and to grow from one another, and I think that's what this is talking about. We sharpen each other as we share our different perspectives and grow wiser because we start to see things from other people's eyes as we share those different perspectives. No person can always be right by themselves, and wisdom is actually gained by allowing others to sharpen us. So that kind of makes sense that way. So verse 18, whoever tends a fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who guards his master will be honored. Okay, I've done, when I lived up in Pennsylvania, I've done a lot of vegetable garden. And one thing that I've found out is the more that you tend vegetables and the more that you take care of them, the more you get out of them. I mean, it's just the way it is. You take care of them, you fertilize them, you pick them up out of the dirt when they fall, you get a lot more vegetables. If you run out of time and you don't take care of them and they get kind of run down, then you don't get as much out of it. And I think this is what this is saying, is this principle carries over into the work area as well. The more we put into our jobs, the more that we'll reap the benefits of having that job. Whether it's titles or raises or promotions or praises. Look, that rhymed, see? We'll only get out of a job or a career or anything like that what we're willing to put into it. So I think the best possible reward that we could get, if we're looking for a reward, is the knowledge that we've done everything we can to do the best job that we could, as if we were working for Jesus, as if we were working directly for him. So, I mean, that feeling right there is worth more than any of those things that I mentioned earlier. So the more we put into things, the more we're going to get out of them. It's a good principle to live by. Okay, verse 19. As in water, face reflects face, so the heart of man reflects the man. If you see a person's reflection in the water, you can get a clear idea of what they look like. If we're standing next to each other and you look in the water, you know what I look like by looking at that reflection. And if you see how they communicate their attitudes and love, you get a clear idea of what's inside of a person. Their heart, or the essence of who they are and the values that they live for, are reflected in a person's conversation and conduct. And that's how we learn. You know, we spend time with each other and we learn more about each other. We learn. Jesus said in Luke 6:45, the good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and the evil man brings things of evil stored up in his, brings out things of evil stored up in his heart. For out of the overflow of his heart, his mouth speaks. So, you know, it's, I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, we can all put on a good face or a disguise or anything like that, but eventually it's going to come through who we really are. As time goes by, it'll be revealed. So and I don't know why I got off on that, but anyway, this could also be seen as a call to self-examination. And through certain things that are mirrors of our hearts, we can examine ourselves. As the Proverbs is, to me, kind of a book of self-examination. As we examine our hearts, our thoughts and our attitudes, the things that we wish and hope for, where we place our affections and what our intentions in life are, what our intentions in doing things are, who and what we are, and what we're really living for, what we're about. You know, one of the things, and I've said this before, I often ask myself, is, and it's a good check, is like, if I could have anything in the world, if a magic genie popped up and said, I'll give you anything you want in the whole world, what is it that I'd want? And I think that that really tells a lot about where a person's heart is at. And it's a good form of self-examination, I think. An honest answer to that question tells us a lot. But anyway, I think all these things need to be brought before God on a regular basis. And the self-examination, just to see where our hearts are at with Him. Are we growing? Are we continue to follow Him? Are we trusting Him more? Things like that. So, verse 20, Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, and never satisfied are the eyes of a man. Okay, unfortunately, we don't hear much about cemeteries going out of business because of a lack of business. The one thing is it's not God's intention, but every one of us here has 100% chance of dying at some point. Unless Jesus comes back, and then we don't have to go through that. And like the grave is never full, mankind never ceases to strive for more. We can have everything that we can possibly see, but we for some reason we still want more. And that's what it's saying here. I mean, this is truth. It's okay to want the latest gadgets, new furniture, a new car, whatever it is that's within your budget or you can afford. I think that it's fine to have nice things or new things or whatever like that. But the problems happen, I think, when we're willing to, compromise who we are or our values or anything like that in order to get them. Or that we would, get ourselves hopelessly and lost in debt or whatever just to attain stuff. It's fun to have stuff, and another thing is we just don't want to try and find our wholeness or fulfillment in it. Or we'll find ourselves on the hamster wheel of life, never finding that fulfillment and just living out a life of emptiness and a bunch of stuff around us that never did it and we can't take care of and things like that. So. Verse 21, the crucible is for silver and the furnace for gold, and a man is tested by his praise. That's interesting to me. I think I've read that a few times, and I've never really thought about it until I did this study. A man is tested by the praise he received. And really what that's saying is, what happens to us when somebody praises us? What happens to us when somebody says, wow, you did a really good job there? Does it bloat us out? Or do we get a gigantic head, become conceited and self-centered about it? Or is it just, another thing and, just continue on praising God and continue on? It tells a lot about a person. And it's interesting because, like I said, I never thought about it that way before, but it's kind of cool. But this is a fiery test of our hearts. So, verse 22. See, I told you I was going to go through these fast. What? Verse 22. A fool in a mortar and a crush. Oh, okay. Verse 22. Crush a fool in a mortar with a pestle, along with crushed grain. Yet his folly will not depart from him. And I would say a good way to look at this is that you can't beat stupid out of a person. You just can't, and that's all there is to it. You can correct a correctable person, a child, a friend, but if someone has been on foolishness, a severe beating is not going to do a thing, and that's just the way it is. But take heart, because there's hope. What? There is, because God can accomplish anything, and God uses the foolish to confound the wise, as we all know, so take heart. Okay, verses 23 through 27. We're just going to go through all these because I think that they all kind of fit together. Know well the condition of your flocks and give attention to your herds. For riches do not last forever. And does a crown endure to all generations? When the grass is gone and the new growth appears and the vegetation of the mountains is gathered, the lambs will provide your clothing and the goats the price of a field. There will be enough goat's milk for your food, for the food of your household, and the maintenance for your girls. Okay. So when was the last time you had a nice tall glass of goat's milk with your girls? Obviously, this was written in a different culture. I mean, there's no doubt about it. This was written in a different culture. And all kidding aside, there is a great deal of wisdom in these verses. So, in this culture, this farming and shepherding and things like that were a large industry, and even not even an industry, but something that just about every person did in order to to bring food into their house and to maintain just basic maintenance of their family and stuff like that. Even people of wealth would have been involved in this, because in part everyone depended on it for their sustenance and their daily needs. So if a herd became ill or run down and no one was caring for them, they'd not only run out of a supply of food, but they may actually, the animal may get sick and die, and that would, become a great expense for the family. They didn't have like a Walmart or a Publix or something like that to run down and get more chips and salsa or, whatever. They had to depend on the things that they got from their herd and their livestock. They mostly grew and raised what they ate. So in this culture, it's different, because for the most part, we depend on the income from our employment. We, a lot of us don't own goats and cows and things like that, but we have a job that supplies the basic needs for our family. We have a career or a business or something like that that brings in those things. So I'm not trying to say that it's not God who's sustaining us, because it is God. He provides those jobs and those careers and those ways that we can earn for our families, instead of having to go out and farm for them. But I would say this, like an earlier proverb that we saw, I would say that this proverb is calling us to take our employment seriously, no matter what it is we're doing, to see our jobs as a blessing rather than some kind of an entitlement, and to care for every aspect of them, to be aware of what's going on and to look after them. Paul says in Colossians 3:23, that whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord. And, it talks about crowns and riches coming and going, and the same thing is that job titles and careers and businesses are going to come and go. But a work attitude and a work ethic that's like this will continue to provide for your family, indefinitely. Will continue to provide for you and your family. And I think that's what it's talking about mainly. It's talking about that attitude towards work and that attitude that develops a good work ethic that can, that can support a family forever as that kind of a thing. So, and I think that's going to be about it. I've wrapped it up and that was okay, huh? It wasn't too bad. Did I run late? I can't even see that. Thanks, guys. All right. Does anybody have any questions? Cool. Okay, I know we have... Oh, yes, Teresa. No, go ahead.